Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the September NJEDA board meeting. At this time, all phone participants are in a listen-only mode. Please be advised today's meeting is being recorded. When the chairman opens the public comment portion of the meeting, members of the public attending by phone will be advised to press 1, then 0 on your telephone keypad to be placed in a queue to speak and provide comment. You will be asked to provide your name and any organization of with which you're affiliated. You may withdraw your question at any time by repeating the 1, then 0 command. And if you're using a speakerphone, please pick up the handset before pressing the numbers. If you should require assistance during the call, please press star, then 0. I would now like to turn the conference over to Chairman Terry O'Toole. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Operator. I'd like to call the meeting to order and ask Tim to read the open public meeting notice.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman. Good morning, everyone. In accordance with the Open Public Meeting Act, notice this meeting has been sent to the Star-Ledger and the Times of Trenton at least 48 hours prior to this meeting, and a meeting notice has been posted on the Secretary of State's, I suppose Lieutenant Governor's, bulletin board at the Department of State.
Thank you, Tim. Muneera, could you call the do the roll call, please?
Chairman Terrence O'Toole.
Present.
Vice Chair Charles Carlo.
Here.
Phil Lalagia.
Here.
Virginia Bauer.
Here.
Fred Dumont.
Here.
Aisha Glover. Marcia Marley.
Here.
Jewel Antoine Johnson.
Here.
Robert Shimko. Robert
Here.
Shimko. Thank you. Aaron Cruz for the executive branch.
Here.
State Treasurer Elizabeth Moyo.
Here.
Acting Commissioner Justin Zimmerman for Banking and Insurance.
Here.
Keith White for Commissioner Robert Angelo for the Department of Labor.
Here.
Elizabeth Dragon for Commissioner Sean Lazarette.
Here.
Of DEP. Okay, Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum.
Thank you, Muneera, and thank you, everyone, all board members, for attending and making such an effort today. We're going to do the regular board meeting minutes from the July 26th board meeting. Before members of the board are the meeting minutes from the July 26th NJEDA board meeting for review and approval. I would ask board members state their names for the record when making a motion or seconding. Could I hear a motion to approve the July 26th board meeting minutes?
Moyo moves.
Thank you. Second? Thank you, Jewel. Any discussion, any questions? Hearing none, could I hear a vote? All those in favor, aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Recusals or abstentions? Hearing none, the board minutes are approved. Let me make my brief chairman's remarks. First, good morning and welcome to the NJEDA September board meeting, which is also our annual meeting. Before we begin, I'd like to take a moment and remember the 22nd anniversary of the 9/11 attacks yesterday, September 11th. I had the honor of serving with our board colleague and my dear friend Ginny Bauer on the National 9/11 Memorial and Museum Board as New Jersey's representative for 4 years, and found it to be an incredibly moving tribute to those we lost and to the resilience of New Jersey, New York, and the entire nation to rebuild. And so let me just ask for a brief moment of silence to remember the friends we lost.
Thank you.
In addition to the usual monthly agenda that we have, which is a very full one today, this is also the annual meeting held each September, established by the authority's bylaws. The annual meeting is an opportunity to elect officers, appoint members to committees, establish a calendar of meetings for the next year, and deal with other administrative matters to help ensure the seamless and uninterrupted operation of this board and the EDA. We have a full lineup of projects for you to consider today, all of which support Goal Central to Governor Murphy's plan for a stronger and fairer New Jersey economy. Cementing New Jersey's role as a national leader in innovation continues to be a top priority for the Murphy administration. This includes tasking the NJEDA with developing and implementing creative solutions for addressing longstanding issues concerning access to capital for entrepreneurs and up-and-coming companies in our state. One innovative solution, perhaps the state's most responsive solution to addressing the needs of young companies, is the New Jersey Innovation Evergreen Fund, or NJIEF, but instead of saying that a lot, I'm going to refer to this as the Evergreen Fund. The Evergreen Fund both injects capital into emerging companies and offers an opportunity for larger, more established venture firms to help foster the next generation of iconic New Jersey life sciences companies and other technology companies, along with our broader innovation ecosystem. Established under the New Jersey Economic Recovery Act, or ERA, of 2020, and signed into law by Governor Murphy in 2021, the Evergreen Fund allows the state to become an equity investor in innovative early-stage companies based in New Jersey. We have allocated a total of up to $300 million to directly invest in those companies. We also invest alongside so-called qualified venture funds, or QVFs, who can invest another $300 million for a total of $600 million. The Evergreen Fund forms a platform for collaboration among the state's established corporations, venture capitals operating anywhere in the world that might want to invest in New Jersey, and high-growth businesses operating in our state. In tandem with their strategic engagement to support the innovation ecosystem in the state, the capital raised from the sale of tax credits auctioned off to 8 corporations in the fall of 2022, is expected to result in the funding of initial investments in the high-growth businesses in New Jersey. To date, the board has approved 7 venture capital firms that can now access funding from the Evergreen Fund. These QVFs are eligible to access up to $12.5 million annually per investor from the Evergreen Fund to co-invest in innovative, high-growth, New Jersey-based businesses. Today, the board will be presented with a proposal and asked to approve 3 additional venture firms to participate as QVFs. This well-thought-out and well-executed program is representative of the intentional approach the NJEDA has been taking under the Murphy administration to create opportunities and address long-standing systemic economic challenges in our state. With that, I'm going to turn the meeting over to Tim for his CEO report. I believe he's going to include some additional information on our efforts in venture capital broadly. Tim, over to you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief with what I have to say, partially because I've got 2 special guests who are going to join me and do some rounding out of the CEO report as part of a renewed steady diet of program updates, not for approval, not for voting, not for any decision-making, but just for some informational updates, in this case, the venture program that Kathleen will provide an update on, and then Christine is going to provide an update on the Main Street portfolio of programs that support small businesses. Before we get into that, though, and that you should look forward to, you know, unless we have a completely jammed agenda, 1 or 2 kind of program-level updates monthly from here on out. Before we jump into that, you know, in addition to the reflection and the sorrow of the 22nd anniversary of 9/11, it's also been a season of sadness in Trenton generally, starting with the passage of the late Lieutenant Governor Sheila Oliver, and followed on with the horrible news last week of Joe Fiordaliso's passing, the president of BPU. And so that has just been a very difficult thing for lots of us to deal with, not only for them as leaders, but for those of us who work closely with them and their teams. Those are 2 people who were unfailingly good to me personally, who provided leadership on so many fronts. You know, we worked really closely with BPU and the team there, particularly on offshore wind and clean energy, and the Lieutenant Governor's leadership on any number of issues that impact our work, from affordable housing to, you know, community revitalization, small business support, is irreplaceable, the leadership from both of them. And so as we carry on there, those efforts and those missions, you know, we do so with heavy hearts, but with the intent to carry on the legacy of both the late Lieutenant Governor and the late President of BPU. At the same time. And of course, you know, as is so often the case, amidst, you know, sorrow and sadness and mourning, there's good news as well. Obviously, it was wonderful to be there in person last week when the governor nominated and Chief Justice Radmer swore in the new Lieutenant Governor, Tisha Wake, who will carry on the work of the Lieutenant Governor and build on her legacy, as well as good news that the governor recently made the Justin Zimmerman's been named the commissioner of the Department of Banking and Insurance. So congratulations to Justin. And formally, I not your first board meeting. You were pre-acting previously, and I suppose you're now formally nominated and all that. So congratulations, Justin, and welcome to the board. Again, before I hand it over to some colleagues, just a couple of quick program updates. Obviously, it's been 2 months since we got together. A lot happens in between the meetings. A number of events to commemorate Hispanic Heritage Month, which kicks off, I believe, on Monday. On Friday, as well as Black-Owned Business Month, which is celebrated in August. We held a number of events and community engagement type activities around that. We also marked and made an announcement that the Sustain and Serve program, which has been such a touchstone success of both our efforts around small business support and COVID relief, as well as food security efforts, which is as a COVID program kind of winding down, but surpassed 5 million meals distributed, which is just extraordinary. Extraordinary in some rights, also extraordinary when you think about that started as a $2 million kind of wing and a prayer, kind of, why don't we see if we can do something interesting, and then blossomed into a game-changing program. So special shout-out to Tara and her team and the many people that support that program throughout the organization. We also made announcements around the asset activation planning grants, and you know, continue to push forward on any number of different initiatives that support, you know, local community revitalization. The other thing I mentioned just before I handed it to Kathleen, yesterday was the official transition in of the staff of the Film Commission to be part of the EDA family. So welcome aboard to the Film Commission staff. I'm in the room right now, but you know, the momentum in film and TV, current, you know, labor relations challenges notwithstanding, with the strikes and everything, the momentum in film and TV in the state is incredible, and having Film Commission and the EDA working seamlessly, continue to work seamlessly together, but also, you know, approach some new challenges, new opportunities together, we think is an extraordinary opportunity. That happened as a result of the bill that the governor signed into law in early July to bring the Film Commission into the EDA fold. So welcome and a deep appreciation to that group of our new team. With that, I will hand it to Kathleen. This is a bit of a Reader's Digest version of an annual deep dive we do at the Audit Committee on all the venture investment activities. This is adjacent to and harmonious with the Evergreen efforts that the chairman was mentioning, but this is where we are acting as an LP and making direct investments in venture funds. And Christina will follow on and talk about small business.
I just also want to say we appear to be in standing room only.
It's a hot meeting.
So
we got a lot
popular. Feel free to come in if you want or bring chairs in. I think there's a few seats in the back and demand for this.
Yeah, people want, they want to know about the venture funds.
Yes. It's very exciting, I think. So thank you all. Good to be with you. I would be remiss if I didn't recognize our venture team that has grown significantly in recent years under Tim Rolander's leadership and Ron McKella, and you'll hear from Alexander Pachman on that team in a little bit. But behind the scenes, there's a lot of work that goes on in deploying assets with venture firms. As Tim mentioned, we step back each year with the audit committee and do a deep dive review of that portfolio of assets. And as the portfolio continues to grow, the results continue to be strong. And in many years that were lean for the EDA, we saw the venture fund returns significantly contribute to the bottom line. And so when you step back and think about why does the EDA invest in venture, it becomes a really important driver for job creation in the state. And many young companies that are not bankable, that are in the innovation space, that's the resource that they go to raise funding, to help grow jobs, and create innovation. Many firms that start as venture-backed companies with one and two people have gone on to grow, you know, hundreds, thousands of jobs in New Jersey and across the world. And at the same time, they're improving the quality of our lives with new innovative technologies. So to support them from an economic development perspective just seems to make sense. Entrepreneurship, as many on this board know, has been a primary driver for economic and job creation, and so it's a natural extension and really a nice complement to what we do on the small business side on our community front to support venture. In New Jersey, we saw some home runs in 2023 relative to capital raises, and that's new money that's coming into the state and being invested to hire employees, to pay rent, to purchase lunches, and you know, the trickle-down effect is significant. So CoreWeave is one of the big numbers that we saw in 2023, a company that's focused on supporting the AI industry, so a supercomputing company. They raised a $420 million round in April, and that was from all out-of-state investors. That capital came into New Jersey. UV, a TNEC-based company, also closed a $100 million round. And if we look back historically, every year we kind of see these two or three large investments in the state of New Jersey. Oftentimes they're in biotech. It's kind of nice to see this year the support for an AI-focused company as a leading and new industry. Next slide, Danielle, if you would, please. And so when we look at our overall portfolio, our direct investments in venture funds as a limited partner, we're alongside other capital providers, has just topped at 20 venture funds with over $63.5 million deployed. We've been in this segment of the business for 20 years now at the EDA. Really started with a local firm called Edison Venture Fund, then it's called Edison Partners now, one of the few venture funds that was really in the state of New Jersey. Our second foray was really to be the lead LP and creator of the New Jersey Technology Council Venture Fund that we really served as a catalyst to get that fund off the ground because we didn't have enough venture capital firms in New Jersey. And that continues to be the challenge that we see in the state. There's not enough homegrown venture funds. We believe the Evergreen Fund is going to help string that solution together. We see a lot of out-of-state investors come into New Jersey. Over three-quarters of the capital in New Jersey comes from out-of-state investors. So we need to find a way to continue to prime that pump. We think the Evergreen is the way to do that. The great news is in the 20 investments that we've made today, 90% of that is funded. That means 10% of the capital is still available to invest in new companies in the state of New Jersey. We're extremely cognizant of making sure that we have available capital in our LP portfolio to invest in New Jersey companies. We don't want to go dry there. And consistency in the venture market is really critical to long-term success. So when we see that we've been doing this for 20 years, we haven't pulled out in difficult times, we're seeing strong returns at 1.8 times cash return multiple of the dollars that we've invested into companies. But what's also extremely impressive, we believe, is the ability to leverage private capital. So leverage from the sense of public money to private money. So for every dollar that we're putting into a venture capital fund, those companies are going on to raise 56 times more capital. So we're hoping that that is a catalyst that we're in these funds. We require these funds to invest in New Jersey via side letter agreement, and then they bring other capital to the table for these companies that are in New Jersey.
Again, it's important for everybody. Leverage here is not debt.
Not debt, right.
Because you mean we invest a dollar, $56 are coming from someone else into the state.
Exactly, Terry. Okay. And so it's
some of that coming in some desk. Some
yeah. So what you heard from Terry in his opening comments is the Evergreen Fund. That is one solution that we're taking, but we're really building out the entire venture portfolio. So this board has seen before them requests for a number of state small business credit initiative, SSBCI, funded venture funds. So that's a federal program that's allowing us to deploy capital. We have 8 funds that were approved under SSBCI and as well as the Black and Latino Seed Fund, which this board also approved. Next slide. So I mentioned consistency is key here. We've seen that the venture capital markets are certainly slowing based on current economic conditions. If you look at this graphic, you'll see that New Jersey is following the national trends. When the national dollars invested peaks, we've peaked. When the dollars are slowing, we're slowing. But what I think is really important is what's going to come next, right? So the market is quiet. There's not a lot of venture capital dollars. as Terry mentioned, Chairman mentioned, we've approved 7 funds. We have 3 more today for the board. We'll have 10 venture funds that we are incentivizing to invest in New Jersey in what we believe is going to be a difficult market continuing for these young companies to raise capital. We think that's a game changer for New Jersey to have that number of venture funds and the requirements that come with it, with these approvals, to meet with companies in New Jersey, to spend time with the companies in New Jersey. We're hoping that we're going to buck these trends. So I'm hoping when you see this data next year, you'll see New Jersey in a very different position than the national level because of many of the approvals that this board has taken to date.
You know, one thing when we discussed this in committee, one other interesting sort of, you know, fact is New Jersey actually has an innovative economy. There could be states that don't have the sort of infrastructure and, you know, entrepreneurial spirit that we do. So we're fortunate in that.
Yeah, we're the smart state. We always have the most scientists, technicians, engineers
per square mile. We continue to be.
That's right. So we should be taking advantage of that talent, which you are.
Absolutely. Next slide, Danielle. And so, again, we're looking at this as an entire portfolio now, just not LP positions, but we now have our SSBCI funds. We also have our Evergreen fund. And what is consistent throughout the approach that we've taken on all these venture funds is making sure that our DE&I work is front and center. We believe that we've taken a leadership role in our approval process around DE&I with the support of Michelle Bowden and her team to make sure that every firm that we work with has a DE&I policy and we're measuring them against that policy, as folks have heard on the committee calls. So to supplement that portfolio and, again, make sure that we are hitting targeted pieces of the population that weren't supported previously. The governor put aside money for the Black and Latino Seed Fund, $20 million, through 2 different budget appropriations. Those dollars have now been committed through this board to 3 different funds. What's interesting to me is the funds are from all over, so New York, California, and all are setting offices up here in New Jersey to deploy this capital. Complementing the Black and Latino Seed Fund is the SETI Seed Fund, Socially and Economically Disadvantaged Individuals. That is a federal acronym, and we're using our SSBCI federal money for that, so $20 million there. So Include Venture Partners got $15 million, Generator $5 million. Again, what we're seeing from both the Black and Latino seed fund managers and the SETI seed fund managers is they're going into communities that we've never had venture before in New Jersey. So indications of offices opening in Camden, Trenton, and Newark, where we think should be our innovation hotbeds. And then finally, as you'll hear more today, the New Jersey Innovation Evergreen Fund, with firms from California, New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey. Hopefully we'll hit double digits with today's approval and bring it up to 10 qualified venture firms. And again, these firms have requirements for office hours in New Jersey, for meeting with companies. We'll put their logos up on our website, ways to contact them. So the pool of available capital to the state's entrepreneurs continues to grow. And so just in closing, next slide, Danielle, if you would, please. We still have $6.5 million of uncommitted capital from our LP positions in our traditional venture funds. We have approved $80 million of capital on SSBCI. 20 has been committed for SETI funds, $25 million for life science funds, $20 million for the Black and Latino seed fund managers, and now $46 million raised for Evergreen. In my 18-year career at the EDA and running venture programs, we've never had this volume and capacity. And again, I hope that when we visit this again, this time next year, you'll see New Jersey's trend bucking the national trends and the impact of the commitments here. So thank you to this board for all your support in driving this.
How do we get the word out? How do potential investors know about us? From a state perspective, I feel like New Jersey should be taking a bow. What can we do to improve that? Because, sometimes it's
all the, you know, the reputation and the aura that will even attract more and more activity.
Yeah, it's a bit of a Me Too industry, quite candidly, venture firms, right? They all cluster in California, Boston, and New York. And so we're really taking a grassroots approach, and Tim Alder from our venture team maybe can speak to the work of the team. But we're doing direct outreach, and Tim, maybe you can talk to our penetration rates on talking to those firms. Pretty high, right?
Yeah, thank you for putting me on the spot. yeah, and Curtis Lee, who's on, give a holler to the phone folks in here. Oh, sorry, yeah. You know, we talk about it pretty frequently. How do we get the message out there? I mean, it's an EDA-wide problem. Like, there's so many great resources here. How do we just get that out there? So, you know, programs like this are an opportunity every day to build out new strategies, build out new relationships, and kind of continue to pursue those opportunities, those paths. Fish evergreen to 100 firms.
Yeah, and I would think they, you know, they know we're here to support them and help them and give them the money that usually that will spread. So I just want to be sure that works.
And I think that's it. I think it's going to be a we've got to prove it, right? And every conversation that we have, folks say about the Evergreen Fund in particular, really, like, this is really good. And the tax credit auction, you know, folks. They were hesitant to participate, the corporate side, and once they went through the process, they're like, this was efficient, we got our tax credit quickly, we're here to engage, and we'll be at the table for the next auction. So I think it's up to us to prove it out. We hopefully will be coming to the board in October for our first investment transaction. And again, the naysayers have said, we don't think government can move fast enough. We don't think you can do an efficient program, so, you know, give us a challenge, and we want to prove them wrong, and then we'll shout it from the rooftop. Thanks. Great. Thanks, everyone.
Light moment as we transition to Christina. It's about getting the word out. So last night, if you had been listening to the Jets game on the radio, you might have heard some of the spots for our pushing the awareness of these small business programs, in particular that Christina and Maggie and I are responsible for. So it is the as part of a season-long campaign. It is the official position of the New Jersey EDA that we are set about Aaron Rodgers' Achilles tendon.
Yes.
We may pass a resolution ordering him back on the field. Without weighing in on Giants, Jets, Eagles, any of that, we are upset about Aaron Rodgers professionally and officially. Bruce is upset. We didn't tell Bruce about the but to that end, getting the word out about small business and our mainstream programs is even harder than venture because there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of small businesses in the state. So, Christina, the floor is yours, and let's tie you on a frame.
You got it.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. I'm Christina Fuentes. I'm Vice President of Community and Business Development. So, as I'm sure everybody is aware, Economic Recovery Act passed under Governor Murphy. The Main Street Recovery Finance Program was essentially part of the suite of incentives that were created, which really allowed for EDA to essentially create a Main Street Recovery Fund to do products. So this fund creates the products that are going to support grants to small businesses defined by SBA, but also loans to micro businesses. And we define micro businesses as 10 or fewer employees, and then also making less than $1.5 million in revenue. We also have the ability to create resources for lending partners as well, too, because we really leverage those EDFIs, but also CDCs, our community development corporations, from the local level. So our Main Street Recovery Fund so far has processed over 7,000 applications. We've done $124 million in approvals, and this has served over 3,819 businesses. So as you can see, fairly short time. It took some time ramping up programs, but our impact has been pretty great. And that's served 34% minority-owned businesses, 32% women-owned businesses, and 2% of those businesses were veteran-owned. We've also, the awardees were, a third of them went into eligible opportunity zones. So the suite of products that we have received so far $150 million, but with fiscal year 24, we've received an additional 50, so we'll be able to allocate those into these programs. But I'm going to highlight the Small Business Improvement Grant first, and our Small Business Lease Grant e-commerce program, which is administered by Maggie Peters, who is the Assistant Director of Small Business Services. For our improvement grant, it really reimburses a business owner that essentially did capital improvements or made purchases of furniture, fixtures, and equipment in the last 2 years prior to application. So it really allowed those businesses that were investing in their business to qualify for up to $50,000, and we've already approved 1,518 of those so far. And then with our small business lease grant, which businesses can tap into both of these as well too, really supports an early stage business owner that goes into new space. We allow them to get 20% of their annual lease payments at approval, and then 12 months later, they come back for another grant, because a lot of times we realize, you know, businesses, they may be in a lease space, but they're not actually open operating. So it's a really struggle for a business when you can't generate revenue, but you have expenses and money going out the door. So this allows them to really come into a space and build up their longevity for that to make 5 years and be able to survive. We also have our e-commerce support program as well too. That was one of the last ones. It's only been open for 6 months, but we've already done 125 approvals so far. So we've used up the nearly $1 million that we allocated, and we'll put more funding in there because we have $4 million for that. And then our last two products, which are our Main Street Business Loan, and then also our Lenders Grant, which is on our business banking side, and that's administered by Naima Marshall, who is our Assistant Director of Business Banking. So our Main Street Micro Business Loan, we took in 1,998 applications last October. We are down to our last 26. So we were able to fully fund the queue that came in. So because of this appropriation, and that's how impactful it is. And as you can see, we've already done $65 million in approvals. We'll be able to fund all the people that are eligible with that as well, too. And then our last piece to this is where we really leverage our partners is our Main Street Lenders Grant. So it's like really perfect timing to have this product while we were launching the micro business loan because it became oversubscribed. We kept it open for 24 hours, but then we were able to keep this as a reference for people so they can essentially see, like, okay, there's $8 million for loans, which those micro loans are able to really support those micro businesses as well. But the technical assistance, they've already served 312 micro businesses.
The average size here is $20,000 to $40,000.
So it really depends on the product, right? So everything's really, except for Main Street Lenders Grant, which goes to entities, that's $1.5 million. But I would say based on awards, we're somewhere close to that. Yeah.
That's to the CFI, which then relends,
yeah.
Right? Okay.
Our lease grant is actually higher because it's 2 years. It's two grants essentially, right? We didn't cap the amount, but we do cap essentially. It's a first floor space because it's supporting Main Street, but also we say your grant's eligible for the first 10,000 square feet. Now, if you have over 10,000, you're still eligible, but we support
10,000.
But, you know, obviously our Main Street microbusiness loan, that was a working capital loan up to $50,000. And it was for early stage businesses. So pretty much everyone went for $50,000. So the average is around $48,000 or so. Our improvement grant is close to, I want to say, like $28,000, $30,000, just because it's a reimbursement. So remember, they have to put that money out the door and then get reimbursed. So some people, if they made those capital improvements, they spent well over $100,000+. But we're able to get that full 50, but majority are coming in more for furniture, fixtures, and equipment. And this is just more of a heat map. Sorry for the grid. It's a little hard to see the numbers and how big they are and the impact. But we've touched every county. Every county has received awards, as you can see, you know, obviously. But it's really nice to see more of the counties that are tapping into the dollars and funding that's available for them. I will say part of this is we have a liaison team that does a lot of outreach, and that's really out there, boots on the ground, really meeting counties, cities, you know, all the specific chambers, especially in the regions, just let them know these funding sources are available still. We're really the only entity that's still doing grants. This is a huge impact for the state. I broke down the products that the Main Street Lenders Grants were able to support. As you can see, these state partners provided really attractive products for micro businesses to get reduced interest rates, longer term, but also reduced credit scores as well, too, right? So that was part of what we did is, you know, we can see a CDFI wants to stick technically with their portfolio, but in order to access capital, we wanted to kind of make it a little bit more attractive for the business owners. So we provide the funding that allows the CDFI to take the risk. And Mrs. Bauer was talking about how do we put it, our word out there. There you go. So we have launched our My Small Business Big Improvement Stories. And I really love this because we actually get the business owners to record themselves, highlight their business, and it's personal. Exactly. So I really enjoy watching this, but also you can see the impact that we have on some of these small businesses. Like this gentleman makes granola, and he's actually going to be able to sell more on Amazon. He's actually in an industrial space. So a lot of people think
a little shark tanky, right?
Yeah, and that's what I love about it, because you can actually see how they're engaging and using our products, and hopefully other business owners can see that as well, too. So, sorry, I get a little passionate about what I do, but I don't know. Any questions or?
Any questions?
The only answer is you had the number of applications, which is a huge amount. The number of approvals is a huge amount.
Yeah.
Most of the folks who fell down in between an application approval were in the lease grant because of the very specific eligibility.
Also, we launched during COVID, and a lot of people thought it was similar to another program, which it wasn't, but yes.
To access the lease program, you have to either take new or expanded lease space.
Yes.
But you approved almost 50%.
Yeah,
right?
That's good.
I mean, we still, well, because we had conversations with people, like, you know, and, which equates to withdrawals because they didn't realize they weren't eligible for it. But I will say people who didn't get the lease grant got the microbusiness loan. So it was nice to see that they had, and you essentially could have gotten all three. We don't have a duplication of benefits issue, like when the federal programs, because it's state appropriations. So we allowed the ability for people to get more programs just because, again, they're reduced amounts. These aren't big grants, but helps them stagger that support to really help them survive. Typically, all the compliance is around 5 years because, again, if we're investing, and you want to keep those Main Street businesses in the Main Street because it helps the cities as well, too, right, which equates to keeping your city, you know, clean and safe and having that perception. Vacancy rates can, you know, help kind of deter that for a city. So it's all connected down to the community level.
Last thing I mentioned is the stats on minority-owned business participation, women-owned business participation, veterans. You would never declare victory and say mission accomplished because you're only going to as much as you can. Those numbers, Michelle, verify this. You look at other programs, other states, those are pretty damn good. We'd like to want to keep pushing them higher, 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 but a good start. It's a very strong start.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes my CEO, my rather extended, I guess, CEO report.
Way to delegate.
Leadership, exactly.
I'm going to give two committee reports, and I wanted to make one comment at this point. And so, you know, as Tim said, we're going to try to do, at every board meeting, subject to time, one or two of these programs overviews. We're also trying to give you a more fulsome, perhaps, report on the committee meetings because so much of the actual work and decision-making of the board takes place in the committees, which are between our board meetings. And then finally, the other thing, you know, we're now doing, I hope for the last board meeting, several board meetings, people have recognized or using the PowerPoints to kind of frame as we go into each approval, reminding everybody what program we're in because we have so much going on. So we're trying to give the board and the public a broader sense of what's happening sort of between our board meetings. All right, so first I'm going to give a quick report on the audit committee, of which I am the chair. The audit committee met on August 30th and discussed several matters. The venture team provided its annual presentation to the audit committee on the authority's venture fund investments, which is what you just saw a summary of. We get a much more detailed report. Staff provided the committee with an update on the year-to-date fiscal plan, which is positive, running ahead of budget, as well as a status update on the 2022 annual audit, which is
so close to done.
We're also close to 10/23, but that's okay.
It's hard to dispute your observation there, Chair.
Status updates were provided on a number of external audits currently underway and on two compliance audits, which were recently completed with positive outcomes for both the Henry Ida Business Assistance Grant Program and the New Jersey Innovation Evergreen Fund. Staff also presented the committee with the NJEDA's draft compliance plan for review, which is meant to demonstrate the authority's deep commitment to compliance and enforcement of requirements across the EDA. A draft update to the audit committee charter was highlighted for future discussion. I will also give a report on the policy committee, which met on August 29th. The committee began with an overview of the annual meeting memo, followed by a memo seeking to clarify operating authority, which we will discuss later in the board meeting. The members were briefed on a recommendation for a contract award for software services to support the needs of the authority, which we'll also vote on later today.
staff presented a revision to the New Jersey Indoor Amusement Park Grant Program to expand eligibility and increase award amounts, which we'll discuss later today. This was followed by an MOU between the NJEDA and a higher education institution in support of workforce training for offshore wind, which we'll discuss. Staff provided a review of recommendations for additional three companies to be approved as QVS under the Evergreen Fund, which we will discuss. The next section of the committee agenda focused on the Windport. Staff presented two memos, one regarding delegations of authority and one regarding additional funding, the second of which we will discuss in executive session at the end of the board meeting. And of note, one memo was discussed in committee regarding an MOU with a state agency that is not proceeding this month. It will come back to the committee next month. And lastly, a proposed committee charter was highlighted for future discussion as well. Now we're going to move on to authority matters. This is essentially the annual meeting organization, and Danielle Esser, our Director of Governance and Strategic Initiatives, will lead us through this.
Good morning. Members, pursuant to the NJEDA's bylaws, in September of each year, there is an annual organization meeting, and the members are asked to consider the following recommendations associated with that. Charles Sarlo has been serving in the role of Vice Chairman and is recommended that the members approve Charles to continue to serve in the role of Vice Chairman. Traditionally, the position of Board Treasurer has been held by the State Treasurer, who serves on the EDA Board in an ex officio capacity. Members are requested to approve Treasurer Moyo to consider to continue to serve in the role of Board Treasurer. Also, per the bylaws, Tim Sullivan, in his role as CEO, will serve as Board Secretary. Bylaws authorize the appointment of assistant secretaries, which are noted in your board memo. Additionally, per the bylaws, the authority has five standing committees that meet throughout the year. Your memo requests the reappointment of chairs for each of the committees and the members for each of those committees as provided in your board memo. In addition, lastly, your memo request for the reaffirmation of Marcus Salduti as the authority's records custodian and to appoint your assistant records custodian and to reaffirm the appointment of Fred Cole as the ethics liaison officer. Lastly, the calendar of board meetings through 2024 is included in your packet, and you'll note that there are 10 meetings scheduled for the following year. Happy to take any questions.
Any questions? You're ready to serve again?
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you very much. Could I hear a motion to approve?
I'll move it.
Thank you. Jenny, second?
Dragon, second.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Hearing none. The organizational matters are passed. Thank you, Danielle. Now we're going to move on to venture. There is one presentation, which is on the three potential new firms for the QVF program in Evergreen. Alexander is going to present. And again, just recall everybody, there's a slide up here in the room, a PowerPoint giving a summary of the program.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you. I'm pleased to be with you today to present our recommendations for this month's proposed qualified venture firms, also known as QVFs, under the New Jersey Innovation Evergreen Fund program. QVFs are eligible to apply for funding from the Evergreen Fund to make qualified investments in eligible, high-growth, innovative New Jersey businesses and to gain support and insight from interactions with the program's advisory board. QVF designations are made on a rolling basis, and applications are reviewed in the order in which they are received. The application period for venture firms will remain open throughout the life of the program. We continue to expand our engagement with venture capital firms interested in the Evergreen Fund. For context, we've been tracking more than 100 conversations with interested VC firms since the application period opened in December. Thus far, the EDA has received 17 applications and has previously approved 7 qualified venture firms. The Venture Programs Department is presenting an additional 3 qualified venture firms for approval this month. Following staff review, the recommendations offered here today have met all program eligibility requirements and minimum scoring requirements as determined by the EDA's Venture Programs Department in conjunction with the EDA's Product Operations Department and Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Department. The scoring rubric and results for each application are detailed in the recommendation memorandums in your packets. The three QBF applicants recommended for certification today are Creative Ventures Management, LLC, a minority-owned California-based early-stage venture capital firm investing in deep technology companies, scoring 22.5 out of 30 possible points. Emerging Fund Management, LLC, a Chicago-based growth equity fund investing at the intersection between the technology and restaurant space, scoring 18.5 out of a possible 30 points. The Emerging Fund recently applied for a program-qualified investment into a New Jersey-based innovative business, which is currently under staff review. And finally, Vamos Ventures Management Company, LLC, a minority-owned California-based early-stage venture capital firm that primarily invests in companies led by Latinx founders, scoring 28 out of a possible 37 points. QBF applicants that meet all program minimum requirements as outlined in the memorandum are scored based on the program's weighted criteria evaluation model, which was approved by the board in April 2022 and is made publicly available on the program website and in Appendix A of the cover memorandum. The evaluation methodology places a material emphasis on venture firms' diversity, equity, and inclusion policies and track record of progress towards policy goals, which is independently evaluated by the EDA's diversity, equity, and inclusion team. As previously approved by the board, the model incorporates dynamic scoring, whereby venture firms that have had a robust diversity, equity, and inclusion policy in place for at least 1 year face an increased maximum score and minimum required score. These firms may demonstrate progress against their previously established DE&I policy goals to earn additional points in the scoring model. This month, Vamos Ventures has maintained a DE&I policy for at least 1 year. Encouragingly, the firm was able to demonstrate progress towards their policy goals as evaluated by the EDA's DE&I team. Notably, 100% of Vamos Ventures portfolio companies are diverse-led, and 86% are Latinx-led. Both Creative Ventures and Emerging Fund created formalized DE&I policies within the past year. Emerging Fund formalized their policy as a result of their program application, demonstrating the program's ability to catalyze increased efforts around DE&I within the innovation ecosystem. As a reminder, continued program eligibility will require the firms to demonstrate efforts made towards their policy goals as verified by the EDA's DE&I team on an annual basis. Staff plans to continue to present additional QBFs for approval on a regular basis throughout the life of the Evergreen Fund program as we seek to build a pipeline of engaged venture capital partners to invest in high-growth New Jersey businesses. I'll conclude my prepared remarks by reiterating staff's recommendation for approval of the three applicants as qualified venture firms. Thank you for your consideration. We'll take any questions at this time.
Questions? Any board members on the phone?
No, but Aisha Glover, I did join at 10:15.
Hey, Aisha. Okay, let's. Hearing none, I'm going to ask for a motion to approve.
I'll move it.
Thank you. Second?
Okay.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Hearing none, could I ask for a vote? All in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you, Alexander. Ginny, do you want to give a quick report from the Incentives Committee?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Incentives Committee met on August 28th, and the staff provided a review of recommendations for the 2023 program approvals for the Technology Business Tax Certificate Transfer Program, WOW, or NOL. This year, staff are recommending more than 30 technology and biotechnology companies to be eligible for the program. Also, staff provided a review of recommendations for modification to the manufacturing voucher program, phase two, which will provide additional funding and funding bonuses for smaller manufacturers. Staff also provided one Aspire project located in Newark to the committee for consideration. The staff also presented an update to the Grow New Jersey rules to add qualified CPA certification of annual reporting as a requirement to increase efficiency and consistency across the program. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ginny. The first item under incentives is the, I'm just going to go with the NOL program. Okay. And Christopher, you're on.
Okay. Hello and happy Tuesday. I'm Christopher Shires, the Senior Product Officer for NOL and ATC, and today I'm going to overview of the 2023 NOL program. The program enables biotechnology and technology businesses to sell the tax offset created by their unused net operating loss carryover, NOL, and unused R&D tax credits. It's an annual program. Applications are due on June 30th, and then they're going into review and ideally approval during the board meeting. NOL may award up to $75 million in tax credits annually, of which $15 million is earmarked for companies in opportunity or innovation zones, or are certified as minority or wind business enterprises in New Jersey. The maximum lifetime cap of $20 million for companies participating in the NOL program. The eligibility requirements are that there are fewer than 225 U.S. employees. This includes any parent or subsidiary companies. They have protected proprietary intellectual property, which is a patent or a copyright at the Library of Congress, or exclusive license to either. They have a New Jersey base of operations with a minimum number of full-time employees based on the years of operations. Fewer than 3 years is required to have one full-time employee. Between 3 and 5 years, required to have 5 full-time employees. More than 5 years, required to have 10 full-time employees. They must have independent CPA-prepared financial statements based on U.S. GAAP standards with 2 consecutive years of operating losses. Next slide. So this is the 24th year of the program, and NOL has provided significant impact to the New Jersey technology and business biotechnology industries. Since 1999, the program has approved more than $1.95 billion in tax benefits to more than 580 companies in the NOL program. Examples of success include Prevention Bio, which was acquired by Sanofi. Prevention was awarded between 2018 and 2022 a total of $18,980,102 in tax benefits. Insmed, which is a public traded company, was awarded from 2012 through 2015 a total of $15 million, which was the prior NOL cap for the program. And Celgene, which was acquired by Bristol-Myers Squibb, was awarded from 1999 through 2004 $8,753,338 in tax credits. Next slide.
Can I ask one question before you go?
Of course.
Those are New Jersey tax credits, correct?
That is correct.
So this is not federal tax. This is just their...
It's the offset of their
offset of their
tax credit. Next slide, please. So program highlights for 2023. 39 companies requested a total benefit of over $166 million in tax benefits. Program highlights specific to this year. Applications increased by 40% since 2022. 70% of the applicants were biotech. 60% were privately held companies. 54% included DE&I information, which is self-disclosed voluntary information to evidence diversity within the companies. And 41% were new to the program. 34 companies are recommended for approval in 2023. They requested over $158 million in tax benefits. A list of these companies is recommended that are recommended is provided with their location and a brief business description within the memo. 2 companies elected to withdraw their applications. 3 companies are recommended for declination. Companies are declined for failing to provide sufficient evidence that they meet NOL program requirements. Detailed reasons for declinations are in the memo. These companies retain the right to appeal. This concludes my prepared remarks, and I welcome any questions you may have.
Board members?
Thank you.
Anyone on the phone?
Daniel's got a public service announcement.
Mr. Chairman, we just have to share for any folks who are present prior to the board's vote, pursuant to the authority's public comment policy posted on the authority's website, the single person speaking on behalf of an applicant being recommended for decline will be permitted to speak for a maximum of 3 minutes.
Thank you. Do we have someone to speak today?
You can ask if somebody wishes to speak before the board vote.
Anybody here in the room? Anyone on the phone wish to speak?
On this item only.
On this item only? Yeah, we'll do public comment on whatever you wish later. Hearing none.
Hearing none. All right, could I hear a motion to approve the recommendation from Chris and his team?
I'll move it.
Thank you. Second?
Second.
Thank you. Any further discussion from the board? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed or recusals or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion is approved. Thank you. Next, we go to NJMVP, which is the Manufacturer Voucher Program. Ivan?
Good morning, members, Chairman and members of the board. The members asked to approve the New Jersey Manufacturing Voucher Program Phase 2, extending the pilot initiative that offers grants in the form of reimbursement to New Jersey manufacturers. This program aims to facilitate access to essential equipment, enhancing efficiency, productivity, and overall profitability in New Jersey manufacturing. Two, the utilization of $20 million from the fiscal year 2024 budget to capitalize the NJMVP program phase two. The utilization of up to $4 million from this allocation to be used for waitlisted companies from phase one. And also $1 million of funding is to be used by the authority to cover administrative costs that are needed to administer NJMVP phase two. Furthermore, amending NJMVP specifications so that eligible applicants with 50 or less full-time employees qualify for an additional 5% funding bonus. The authority will also streamline applications, eliminating the pre-qualification process that was present in phase one, and all other aspects of the program remain. Fourth, delegation of authority to the Chief Executive Officer to approve certain individual applications for NJMVP program phase two with the parameters set forth in this memo and the attached program specifications. Lastly, delegation to the Chief Executive Officer to accept additional funds from any available governmental funding source, federal, state, or county municipal, to further fund the second phase of this pilot program. So it's important to talk about some of the phase one stats before we move on to phase two. With phase one, we had a total allocation of $33.75 million, which translates to 235 approvals, with an additional approximate 30 companies that are on the wait list. Those 30 companies will be funded with phase one money and up to $4 million from this $20 million allocation from 2024. This program was able to leverage approximately $134 million of equipment purchases, which translates to about $4 spent to every $1 that we provided in assistance. Phase one also saw that we were able to get applications from 20 different counties. The only one county that we did not get an application from was Salem County, which hopefully that changes in phase two. The second phase of NJMVP will continue to provide New Jersey manufacturers a reimbursement grant to access equipment they need to become more efficient, productive, and profitable. The program also aims to provide grants to manufacturers within their targeted industries or for advanced manufacturing equipment acquisition. Equipment grants range from anywhere from 30 to 50% of the eligible cost of the equipment up to a maximum $250,000.
Was NGT1 all in 1 year?
Yes. It was two different same allocation, but two different times. The initial allocation was $20 million, approved on October 12th, and then we were able to secure an additional $13.75 from the same manufacturing initiative.
But I guess what I'm saying, it happened in a very short period.
That's one. Yeah. Two different applications on one.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. NJMVP Phase 2 will again offer stackable bonuses that will give 5% bonuses for companies in opportunity zones, companies, women, minority, or veteran-owned businesses, businesses that have an active collective bargaining agreement, and also companies that purchase their equipment from a New Jersey manufacturer. For phase two, we're also asking the board to include the following bonuses that were suggested by key stakeholders. We've been able to engage continuously with NJMEP, who has been a great partner of ours through this whole process. And they shared with us that based on their reports, the average size of a New Jersey manufacturer is 32 employees. So using that information, we thought it was would be great to offer an additional 5% bonus for those companies with 50 or less full-time employees. NGMVP also supports small businesses with fewer than 100 full-time equivalent employees by providing a hiring incentive award up to 50%. And phase two will also have a $1,000 application fee and a three-year recapture provision that states that the companies must stay in New Jersey or the equipment school must also stay in New Jersey. Thank you, and I'll take any questions.
For the questions, just two great notes to add to Ivan's presentation. One, this program has been helpful and supportive to a sector that is experiencing a renaissance in New Jersey and across the country. Under Governor Murphy's leadership, we've added nearly 5,000 new manufacturing jobs, which reverses a trend that goes back at least to 1990 when the data starts getting wonky, right, Hansi? There's no multi-year period of sustained job creation in manufacturing going back to at least the early 90s since 2018. So there's been a real positive trend, a real reversal of a trend. The second thing I note is, you know, I think a fair observation we used to hear, you know, earlier in the administration and coming in from previously was, it's great that you have tax credits, great that you have, you know, stuff to support companies that are coming here. What do you have to support the home team? What do you have to support folks that are here and fighting the good fight and want to stay in with a little bit of support, you know, could grow and invest in their business? I think this has been a real signal, not the only thing, but one of the signal deliveries on that challenge from Governor Murphy and the legislature and others to have a sustained commitment to manufacturing. And, you know, this, no one in this program has said, hey, we're leaving if we don't get this money, or we're going to fire people if we don't get this money. It's more, right, we want to grow, please help us a little bit. You know, what can you do to help the home team? And this program's, I think, been a smash success in its first iteration. And cheers to phase two, hopefully, and pending what you have to say.
One addition is that we're looking to launch, it's currently being developed now, and we're looking to launch phase two in January of 2024.
I've been the companies that got approved in phase one. I guess they can't circle back for the funding bonuses. And
yes, yes, they can. There's no restrictions on funding a company who we give a reimbursable grant phase one.
They have a new project. Charles' company can't get paid for the same piece of equipment twice. But if you're
right.
You did something and you want to do something else,
okay, great.
So the companies that are in phase one have completed. You've approved all of. I think you said you had a few companies that you're still under review, right?
So we had a total of 267 applications, about 30 on the wait list. Aside from the wait list, they've all been approved, and they're currently in the closing process.
Okay. Those fund them through the phase one.
Right. So important to note that although we're asking for up to $4 million from phase two money, we're probably only going to use probably 1.5 to 2.
No one in phase one is going to be declined for lack of funds. I mean, folks are declined because they weren't eligible or didn't fit in the program or whatever, but no one's being declined for lack of
funds. Yeah, those companies are currently going through the approval process.
I think you're going to say several board meetings ago, we had a public comment about this from a manufacturer who was declined, right? Or
he was on the wait list. I believe he's in the wait list.
I personally engaged with him, so he was on the wait list, and he was under the impression that it was a first come, first serve, which wasn't the case. And he was very happy after we reached out, and he would be, barring any other eligibility, he will be funded with us.
Great. Any further questions? Any questions from board members on the phone? They're hearing none. Could I hear a motion to approve?
Sir, I didn't listen.
Thank you. Second?
I'll second.
Thank you, Jenny. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion passes. Okay, Kevin, on Aspire, we have one Aspire award today to consider.
Thank you, Chairman. Good morning, folks.
And you'll see you at the next slide.
I love the fact that we now have photos and maps. That's great. So we are seeking your approval to award up to $90 million in Aspire tax credits to a residential project in Newark. The project is located at 8193 Arm Street and is known as the Port Now. Many of you may recall that in July we advanced two projects under previous rules and statute for the program. In spite of legislation that had recently been signed by the governor amending the program.
That amending statute did, however, allow for residential projects to advance under the former rules while immediately taking advantage of specific changes to the law, which are further detailed in the memo. In the case of this project, that is increased project award caps. To do so, an applicant would need to provide a complete application to the authority, a statement in writing electing to proceed under this option, and obtain all applicable approvals under the municipal land use law prior to November 4, 2023. So this applicant has satisfied all of those requirements to proceed under the old program rules while taking advantage of these increased caps. The applicant is proposing the ground-up construction of a 14-story high-rise complex with 357 residential units, including 1, 2, and 3-bedroom apartments. It will also include 8,500 square feet of retail space and a commercial parking component at the site of a current surface parking lot across from the Newark Broad Street, New Jersey Transit Station. The residential unit mix includes 280 market rate units and 70 affordable units. This affordable piece will include 1, 2, and 3-bedroom units with affordability levels targeting household incomes as low as 40% of the area median income. So just to give folks some context, this project is located, again, right across the street from the Broad Street Station. It's in the same neighborhood as Rutgers Newark and the Audible headquarters. But you could definitely say that there's some opportunity for some vibrancy to be added to the neighborhood, and I think this pretty large residential project with some ground floor retail will begin to kind of catalyze that neighborhood and add some of that foot traffic that will support the further kind of development of the neighborhood. MAP Newark Member LLC owning 50%, Portnow Newark Member LLC owning 20%, and Orange Street BD Member LLC owning 30% represent the ownership of the applicant via a pass-through entity, with Orange Street BD Member LLC being the managing member. MAP Newark Member LLC is a wholly owned subsidiary of MAP Enterprises, Inc., which is the current owner of the property and operator of the surface parking lot at the site. Orange Street BD Member LLC is wholly owned by the lead development entity, Bolton Development LLC, via a pass-through entity. The total development budget is roughly $155.5 million. 12 size of the award, we exclude costs that are prohibited by statute and program rules. The total eligible project cost is just over $150 million. The developer must contribute at least 20% equity, or in this case, roughly $31 million. And for this project, equity consists of land valued at $26.25 million pledged to the applicant by MAP Enterprises, sponsor preferred equity of roughly $6.2 million, and $3 million in cash. So this easily exceeds that 20% minimum. The sources table in the memo shows there are other sources of debt in the deal. We subject the applicant's request to the program's various award caps. In this case, the project is eligible to receive up to 60% of total eligible costs, or $90 million, whichever is less, so that would be $90 million. To help further size the award, we look at the project's rate of return. In this case, we use the hurdle rate model provided by EDA's contract and consultant Jones Lang LaSalle. With the benefit of the Aspire tax credit, the equity IRR is 13.8%, which is below the hurdle rate for comparable multifamily residential developments in Newark, New Jersey, of 20.55%. So based on the aforementioned factors, we are recommending an Aspire award up to $90 million for board approval. Happy to take any questions at this time.
Just real quick to hit the highlights. Excellent job by Kevin. It's Fedex, not wearing socks. As always,
I can't tell from here.
Well, I saw
it's still summer.
It's true, it's still summer in your head. I appreciate that. Investing in Newark, transit-oriented development, essentially a vacant, flat parking lot, affordable housing, all good. Lots of good stuff here.
Great job.
Interesting that, you're saying the comparable required rate of return in Newark is 20%-ish, and
yes,
with the Aspire award, it gets to 30%.
Yeah.
So it's still...
Yeah, so this is definitely not in the downtown where you're seeing a lot more residential development. So this is still kind of a
bit of a frontier.
They're making a neighborhood, and I think what you'll see is
right across from the train station.
Right, Broad Street.
Sometimes the downside of rendering this is it makes you see the this neighborhood as it will be. If you took that out and there was that surface parking lot, and if we looked at the aerial, there's a lot of open space still there, and there's a lot of opportunity, I think, for further kind of tag along development. And then so who knows what 5 or 6 years from now, but as it is today, the rents that you would expect in that neighborhood are what they are.
Because this is something that would never get built without this fire.
No, they're kind of planting a flag in that neighborhood, I think.
Right.
And it's going to be a very nice building. It's going to have all the luxury amenities you would expect in that type of building. So
we got to check on these. The
7 years.
7 years. So yeah. If 6 years from now, this neighborhood is the new downtown Brooklyn and rents are through the roof, we'll have a look at the economics and say, well, you actually made a ton more money than you thought you were going to. Mm-hmm. Okay, some interest in equity.
The statute.
What did you say? So if in 6 years, what?
The rents are vastly exceeding what their projections are today. So they're able to make more money. We get to adjust the economics.
Oh, good.
And even more so, the kind of...
We have that insurance, for lack of a better word.
And even so, like the nature of how we calculate that a return, it's kind of based upon the rents, right, the cash flow, but also like the implied value of the asset. So even if they're not making like exponentially more money, if the neighborhood is now appreciated to a point where like we think the building's worth more than it is assumed today, we even get to participate in a portion of that in upside, right? It's not just like are they making more cash flow, right?
That's relevant to all Aspire projects. When we start talking about commercial ones where there are not advancing necessarily the same policy ambitions as affordable housing, TUOD, investing in our cities, that becomes even, I think, more important and more of a feel better about ourselves. We're not overly enriching anybody.
Right. Great.
Okay, any questions, comments? Anyone on the phone? Board members, questions, comments? Okay, hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve the... this specific Aspire award?
Aisha Glover, so moved.
Fred, you
thank you, Fred. Second. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you, Kevin. Susan on Grow NJ.
Never stop talking about NJ.
No. That is the nature of these programs. They stick around a while for compliance. So the request today is to actually go back and amend those GROW agency rules to require the annual reports include a certification of qualified independent certified public accountants pursuant to agreed upon procedures. So all those words mean that we're looking to add kind of an interaction with CPAs into our current jobs reporting model. GROW, which is the predecessor of Emerge, was a job program enacted in 2011. They're currently just shy of 200 active projects that are reporting, about 60,000 jobs a year that we're reviewing. There's a very rigorous reporting requirement every year where there is a job listing that is per month jobs, the explanation of full-time jobs, new, retained. Full-time jobs have to be there 35 hours a week. They have to have offered health care, have a percentage of time at our actual project location. There are bonuses that may be tagged to some of these jobs. There's an awful lot of information we're asking for at these companies. And we have to verify that, of course. That's very time-consuming. We use an MOU with Department of Labor to assist us in that process. And we recognize that it's really a big time commitment for businesses. When we get the reports in, we have an iterative exchange with them, trying to understand on every job level what this information is saying to us. And we feel that our current process has really bolstered our confidence in certifying these tax credits, but we recognize it can cause delays in the issuance of those credits. And as I said, it's quite a lot internally and externally to get this right each year. So we started thinking about what kind of process improvements would work, and we baked them into all of the ERA programs, and now we're coming back and adding this into GROW. And the new wrinkle is that we'd like CPAs to be the ones to receive that job listing first make some of those primary reviews or preliminary reviews, be able to dig into their HR information and get those early pieces of information down for us to streamline our process. Then we would get it, review it, and then be able to move on those tax credits in an efficient and speedier way, but would also really give us the confidence that we have now on the ability to verify those jobs and those tax credits going out into the world. So this is really a new program or a new idea for ERA, but the ERA program hasn't had a chance to implement it yet either. So GROW will be the first to see this process. We plan on having webinars in the coming months to get a list of CPAs that we're going to qualify and put on the list. Businesses will have the opportunity to use those CPAs. It'll be voluntary in the next year, and the mandatory piece will overlay into the 2024 reporting, which we'll see during the first quarter generally of 2025. So we do have a couple exceptions I'll mention. If there are businesses that have great challenges getting an independent CPA on board on time to timely file, we would allow them to continue using their CFO, which is what we do now. And we think this is going to be a really big game changer for us. So if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Yeah, the only thing I'd observe here is, so obviously we went through and continue to go through a tremendous number of challenges and, you know, improvements to GROW in particular, but all of our tax credit programs. I think this is a good example of our objective with compliance should be and is to make it efficient for folks who have done what they said they did or said they were going to do to get the award they were promised, and be tough on folks who can't demonstrate that they didn't do what they said they were going to do. And this makes it easier for the folks who did the right thing and did what they said they were going to do to demonstrate that. Makes it easier for our team to triage that and not have to focus, you know, allocate staff time more efficiently.
But again, good smart change. We're placing trust on the fact that the CPA is making a
correct,
honest evaluation.
Yeah, correct. And our webinars will be program-specific sort of education on not only those programs again, but also what our requirements are and sort of make sure that they understand what our expectations of them are. If we find that we get a report, I mean, a CPA is reported in a manner we think is insufficient, either goes back to them or perhaps they end up off the list. But
these
gives us an option.
You approve the CPAs?
Yes, and we're going to watch how they behave and make sure that we've got quality results from them.
And excuse me, those that use the would use their CFO until they find, they eventually must find a qualified CPA.
I think we're anticipating that would be a one-time ask. It wouldn't be
just like a band-aid,
right,
until they,
yep,
but eventually they'll
that's
be required.
Right. Right. Maybe there's a specific circumstance that year,
right,
that they need this to lean on. But I think we're imagining once this gets in full swing, it'll be pretty easy for those to find their way and jump aboard this CPA train. So.
Companies just like this, so it'll be in their best interest to work.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
protects them.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
I think that's a great component, the CPA qualification. Not to say the CPA is not qualified, but just streamline the process, be consistency, it's the expectation that you said. I think that's really a good component of the program.
It's analogous to the Bob Council that we contain of folks that have the Frequent Flyers Club. We know them. They know how to use our systems.
You know,
it's better if it's qualified. Yeah.
Okay. Any further questions or comments? Anyone on the phone? Okay. Hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve?
I'll go ahead.
Second. Thank you. Hearing any further discussion and hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve? Signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Recusals or abstentions? Okay, hearing none, the motion carries. Now, Charles is going to give a report on the real estate committee, but I am told that I will make a correction for the record. This happens whenever the chairman goes off script. I said that in the committee meetings we approve things, we do not. We discuss things, which are then brought to the board for approval. So just to clarify, we have not somehow recreated the legislative process. So my apologies. So we are clear on the record. Charles?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So our real estate committee met on August 30th. There's two programs that were brought before the committee. As the chairman just indicated, at the committee level, we do discuss programs. We bring staff members to the challenge in terms of what they present to the board members. There were two complementary programs that were presented that ideally, in a perfect world, they would have come to the board together because they are complementary. However, the one program, which was a grant program for municipalities in terms of acquisition of land, board members had a number of questions, concerns. Staff, we tried to work it out through the committee process, but we kind of fell short on time. So that program is put on hold for the staff to go back and kind of not rework it, but fill in some of the gaps, and it'll come back to the committee and then back to the board hopefully next month. But with that said, there was the second program that was presented. We also had a number of questions on that particular program, but we felt that we were able to vet it enough to allow it to come to the board. And that's a $30 million program with COVID funds that will be for really the real estate group here in, at the EDA to take a real estate developer's role in acquiring and developing property for the benefit of local municipalities to stimulate economic development and, I guess, food desert program. So that's an overview. Who's presenting that?
Brian.
I feel like I don't need to present that.
Brian Keenan, Senior Real Estate Officer here at the EDA. I don't have my glasses on, so that's just a blur. I'm not a rest of you, but I'm here today to ask for your approval for the Property Assemblage Fund, which, as the Vice Chair said, is a $30 million Property Assemblage Fund for the EDA to use. So unlike the programs we heard before, this is for the Real Estate Department to work on behalf of the EDA as a developer to develop hard-to-develop projects in communities where our impact will be significant around job creation, community development, and food deserts. These funds are federal funds that have come down to the state and were approved in the 2022 fiscal budget. Properties and projects will range from $1 million to $10 million. These are guidelines because, again, this isn't a competitive outside program. This is for us to use internally. We will focus on projects that will help to anchor and create effective community development. We will do acquisition and site preparation. And so funds will be used for purchase, appraisals, title work, be used for site preparation, utilities, foundations, environmental cleanup, to get sites ready for either lease to a third party or for sale. So these are properties that the traditional markets have ignored. Each project that we identify, we will come back to the board seeking approval on. We will come to you with a plan for the adaptive reuse of that project, how what the EDA's role is, the dollar amount, time development, and the market study. The request today, again, is for the authority board to approve the fund, so the creation of the fund, and for the CEO to enter into an MOU with EDA to receive the $30 million of the SLFR funds here to the Economic Development Authority.
Is there a time frame in which we have to use the funds?
Yes. So these are SLFR funds. They have to be committed toward the project by December 2024 and expensed by 2026. That is currently what the SLFR schedule is. That is subject to change. We in the real estate department think we can meet that, albeit aggressively.
Yeah, this is like the innovation center where this is a policy or a framework,
yeah.
A box for us to color within, and then we bring individual projects back as is when they're ready.
Do you have your sort of list in the drawer of project of properties? Or?
There are a lot of opportunities out there. It's finding the ones that can really leverage. You know, job creation, are there things, and I think using some of the analysis and information that we here have at the EDA, what are the things that are going to promote jobs and promote community development? How can we leverage the additional resources? So manufacturing would be a fantastic one to, but we haven't identified anything yet.
I think it's pretty unlikely you see anything this calendar year, maybe December or something.
But it's a lot to spend in 18 months.
Yeah, it could go chunkily, though, that's a word.
Yes.
This seems a little like a snarky question, so take it the right way. So we're going to try to find things that other developers have overlooked.
Correct.
So, you know, the obvious question is, how come we're going to find something that, you know, somebody in the private enterprise is saying it's not worth my investment?
Totally the right question. And analysis, nothing at this scale is going to get done with this fund. But think Windport, where there's a policy ambition that we have in the state that says we really need a Windport. Mm-hmm. Ideally, a private developer could have done that, but they don't have necessarily the risk appetite or the policy ambition that we do. Food deserts is another example. You know, we might be willing to lose money. This is,
right.
You know,
well, if we're doing the right thing.
We might be willing to do this for little or no return, but we're doing it for policy ambitions. Again, I don't know exactly what the price will be, so it's hard to spell that out. But it's a broader evaluation of value than simply financial value.
Job creation,
community revitalization, and, you know, taking a brownfield that's languished for decades,
right.
Cleaning it up, doing something with it. Again, the private market could do that.
Right.
But if there's,
they don't care.
For whatever reason, they haven't. And there's a market failure or a market gap. This is that prime.
Well, it's sort of
that's the point.
That's what we talked about with Kevin's project, right? Which is it wouldn't be built without the Aspire. Or
correct.
Right. Right. Nobody else would bother.
But you would hope, and I know we talked about this when we did food deserts a couple of meetings ago, that it's economically viable on its own, right? Because
yeah.
Once we launch it.
Correct. But if you can be an acquisition strategy
right.
Like
but
this,
not
lower, the, lower the...
Lower the rural rate, right? Then you might have, then maybe you got something. And it's not the ultimate goal. There's obviously a goal. I mean, correct. Economically, you know, we're looking to hopefully make money, but if we break even, then we're close to it, but we're able to do other good things. We're not going to, this fund is not for us to buy up these property development depots. Yeah. Nothing wrong. Home Depot is where I buy my home improvement goods. Yeah. But the market can take care of that. Yeah. This is if there's a grocery store in Camden, like City or Salem City or wherever else, or...
Right. Where there's a strategic ambition. So again, clean energy manufacturing, go for it, mentioned earlier. So, you know, we're making a big push around a number of clean energy initiatives, but clean energy manufacturing, chips manufacturing, solar manufacturing,
mm-hmm.
where if we can move faster than the market, if we can do something else, we might have like a broader definition of value.
Right.
We can step in.
Okay.
George, anything else to add?
Any further questions, comments from board members, anyone on the phone? Okay, hearing them, so we are approving a policy statement to create this fund and accept the award.
Mm-hmm.
Could I hear a motion to approve?
Motion.
Thank you. Second? Thank you, Jewel. Any further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor, aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
So opposed, refusals, or abstentions?
Brian gets out of the room when he gets there.
He's got 18 months to spend on the money. All right. So, right now.
We're going to prices across the state just shot up. Now the next item is for the Wind Institute. Kathy?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Dear members of the board, the Wind Institute is requesting the approval of the Memorandum of Understanding between the New Jersey Economic Development Authority and the New Jersey Institute of Technology that will enable EDA to provide $399,000 in funding to NJIT for the Professional Offshore Wind Energy Certificate Program, which I will refer to as PowerCert. The MOU utilizes funding from the $10 million allocated via the October 27, 2022 MOU between EDA and the New Jersey Board of Public Utilities for Offshore Wind Initiative. The proposed MOU has a term of 38 months. We are also requesting to provide delegated authority to the CEO to amend or extend the MOU by up to two 12-month extensions if needed, to address the demands for workforce training for employment that require a university degree, particularly positions in engineering and management. NJIT has proposed the PowerCert program, which consists of two graduate level certificate programs. One is the Wind Power Systems and Operations, and the other is Wind Power Economics and Management. Through these specialized graduate certificates, participants will have the opportunity to enhance their knowledge base and career and earning potential. Each certificate is 12 credits, consisting of three core classes and one elective class. PowerCerts will offer 24 scholarships, each at $3,000, and 24 assistantships, assistantships, each at $4,000, primarily for students from minority and underrepresented communities to encourage and support their participation in offshore wind workforce training. Power Certs will begin as a three-year program. Following the 3 years, NJIT will seek private funding to support the program. Ultimately, NJIT intends to build off the initial two certificate programs to develop a master's program in offshore wind, which, if pursued, would be subject to approval by the New Jersey Office of Licensure. Thank you for your time, and I would be able to take any questions that you may have.
Any questions? Anyone on the phone? Hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve? Thank you. Second?
I'll second.
Thank you. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any recusals, abstentions, opposition? Hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you, Kathy. Matt Boyle on an amendment or revision to the NG Indoor Amusement Park Grant Program.
Yes, so this is a modification to the Amusement Park Grant Program. There's three revisions requested. A revision to the New Jersey Indoor Amusement Park Program to expand the eligibility to businesses that are primarily engaged in activities described in NICS code 713110 and 713120. An increase in the maximum award up to $500,000 for applicants that are not in an opportunity zone, and up to $550,000 for applicants in an opportunity zone. And then finally, a delegation to the CEO to award additional funds to eligible applicants if available. The program was originally approved at the February 8th, 2023 board meeting. It gives grant funds for for-profit establishments that operate indoor amusement parks, arcades, and entertainment facilities, and demonstrate a minimum 50% reduction in indoor gross revenue. All applicants from the original board memo were required to list the NICS code 713110 or 713120 to be eligible. The program launched June 15th, 2023, and the application window closed July 31st, 2023. Five applicants applied. None were eligible under the current rules. With these revisions, four of those applicants would be eligible. Also, after review of the application submitted, the losses sustained by the businesses were far greater than the initial award amount, so therefore we're asking for an increase. Any questions?
Hey, Matt, I have two questions. The 50% decline in revenue was over what time period?
It's between April of 2019 to April of it's April 2019 to April 2020, and then from April 2020 to April 2021.
So this is a COVID impact.
Yeah,
correct. Great.
Yeah.
And was the reason the four were declined was because they didn't meet the right code?
Yeah, they didn't have the right code.
And just for everybody's edification, these codes are highly specific in terms of how they classify the establishment, correct?
Yeah, and there's a parent code that's, most of them were listed as 713100, which is like the parent code to the 713110 and 713120, so.
And again, this is, and we are, the establishment has to be primarily in one of those two codes. It can't
correct.
Be, they just have a
room. They have to be primarily engaged in activities in those two codes.
You can't have an NBA jam next to the bathroom.
Yeah.
And count that as an indoor amusement park.
Hit myself
so thoroughly with NBA jam.
The greatest arcade game of all time. What do you want? Any questions, board members?
It's Liz. I have a quick question. Is there any issue from a
requirement aspect on this? I don't know if Gabe is there. Or, would the applicant pool broaden if they had known that the code would have been different?
Hey, Treasurer, it's Tim. Gabriel's not here, but Matt Regan is. But so that's one of the reasons we needed to come back, so we can go back and reapply. There is certainly the possibility that you could see more than those five folks come in. Hard to imagine being multiples of five, but you know, you could certainly see another handful.
We'll repost.
We will retake applications. Those four, actually, those five folks would have to reply if they want to come in. This is a bit of a do-over.
Okay.
Yeah,
we're going to close the application, and then they're going to reapply. So
and restart it. Okay, thanks.
Any further questions? Okay, hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve? Thank you. Second. Thank you, Jewel. Any further discussion? Hearing none. All in favor say aye. Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you, Matt. Loans, grants, guarantees, and investments. Michael, on the hazardous discharge site remediation fund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under DEP's Hazardous Discharge Site Remediation Fund program, we have one municipal supplemental grant application seeking approval for funding. The municipal supplemental grant application exceeds the cumulative delegated authority approval threshold of $1.5 million. This grant request is from the Borough of Glassboro in the amount of $1,241,324 at a project site called the Glassboro Sanitary Landfill. Prior approvals to the Borough for this specific project total approximately $2.1 million. The proceeds of this request will be used to fund remedial action activities at the project site. Upon completion of full site remediation, the property will be redeveloped for renewable energy generation. The remediation of the project site is scheduled to be completed by November 2023. The solar commercial operation is currently being constructed and projected to be completed by the first quarter 2024. Thank you.
Any questions? Anyone on the phone? Motion to approve?
I'll move it.
Second?
Dragon.
Thank you. Any further discussions? Hearing none. All in favor, aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you, Michael.
All right. Thank you.
Chris, on authority matters.
Thank you, Chairman. Over the last 18 months, we've engaged in extensive efforts to update, clarify, expand, and index our delegations of authority. Those efforts started with the board's approval of a new delegation policy and continued with a series of board memos intended to allow the board to focus on things like higher-level policy decisions and program approvals and delegate to the CEO things like individual applications and transaction approvals. So in conjunction with those efforts, today what we're asking is that the members memorialize clarifications to operating authority, and specifically the distinction between what's operating authority versus what's delegated authority. Operating authority is comprised of duties and tasks that are assigned to the CEO, for example, through the bylaws or through our Enabling Act. Typically, they involve things like the day-to-day management of the authority and administrative actions taken to effectuate the board's decisions. In contrast, delegated authority is things that originally lie within the power of the board, and the board has decided to delegate responsibility to the CEO or to staff. We want to clarify that distinction between delegated authority and operating authority, because, frankly, over the years, that distinction has been blurred and has become unclear. So, for example, almost a decade ago, the board approved what was characterized as administrative operating authority, you know, which makes me twinge a little bit. That grid sets staff level authority necessary to execute business transactions, things like signing checks, stuff that wouldn't ordinarily come to the board. So what we want to do, and when we did that a decade ago, it used titles that existed at the time, and it set thresholds, dollar figures that aren't really, you know, we don't use those titles anymore. The thresholds need to be increased. So we want to clarify this distinction, make it clear to everybody what the difference is between delegated authority and operating authority, so we can go back and we can update those now and prospectively. I'm happy to answer any questions. I know you've got a full agenda, so I'll stop there. But if you have any questions, happy to answer.
Anyone on the phone, any questions? I think, you know, as now sort of being a member of the board for 6 months, this is one of the things that we have so much going on, you know, and I've talked to a lot of the public board members individually, distinguishing between, you know, board-level decisions and things that we can delegate is really essential, just given the breadth of programs that we have, and there's we have so much going on. So it's a topic I think will probably be top of mind for quite a while. Okay, any further questions? Do we need approval on this?
We do.
Okay, so the motion...
I can't sign checks apparently or something. We can't order lunch later.
So this is the motion is to memorialize clarifications to the operating authority as originally defined in the attached board memorandum. Could I hear a motion to approve? Thank you. Second? Thank you. All in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any refusals, abstentions, opposition? Hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Tom?
He was warming up on the bulletin.
This is our...
His entry music and everything. Yeah.
This is the request to approve the Microsoft service agreement.
Right. And I want to be very specific. This is all about our software licensing. That is it. So from everything from our laptops licensing, server licensing, Azure services, we use CRM as our database of choice, all of that licensing, all of the development licensing where we build our platforms for applications to launch, that is all included in this Microsoft Services Enterprise Agreement. We're asking for $4.142 million over 3 years. It is a New Jersey state contract vehicle that we're using. The last time we renewed this was 3 years ago. That was the first time we went to the board. That was the first time we reached the threshold where we came to the board for this particular item. We continue to grow. We continue to use more and more services. There's a lot of protective services that we encourage our sysadmins to deploy to layer our protection. We've put in a 20% markup, but we do a true-up every year annually with Microsoft. They just look at our usage, what licenses we've reserved. We do a trip, so if we drop off, it all goes down. If it goes up, it goes up. The 20% is really, though, to keep our eyes peeled. We got a lot of things coming down the road with generative AI, so we just want to keep our eyes open for that. So are there any questions?
Again, we talked about this in committee. The dollar amount is a factual calculation, right? It is what it is.
The state contract pricing, it's the exact same thing that the state pays. And like I said, it's every license that we have. I mean, basically.
You'll see that 4.1 divided by 3, probably not fully, as a line item in the financial plan,
Right.
Do they
require payment up front, even though we're going to put in a budget over 3 years? Do they require payment up front?
Well, no, we pay them every year because it just keeps rolling and rolling and rolling. So, they do a true-up every year in October.
Okay. Any further questions, comments? Hearing none, motion to approve.
I'll move it.
Second.
Second.
Thank you. All in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, motion passes. New Jersey Windport. John.
We have two Windport items. One we're going to do right now with John and public session, public comments, et cetera, and then go into executive session. We're approved. We're going to go into executive session to discuss another matter that John Kennedy will lead us.
Good morning. Board members are asked to approve delegation of authority related to certain actions needed for the development of the Windport project. The Windport's at a critical but exciting stage in its development as we prepare for its first tenant next year. As a result, there are likely certain items that we're expecting that will need to take place in order to keep the development and construction on schedule, but are administrative in nature and in furtherance of already approved board activities. There has been a previous delegation of authority. The board approved delegated authority related to spending thresholds for procured contracts last year. This request looks to expand the delegated authority to three new categories. The first is the execution of license agreements, right-of-ways, and temporary easements. The guardrails for this would be has to be in furtherance of the Windport project as approved by the board. It has to be for consideration not exceeding $500,000. It has to be temporary in duration, 10 years for utility providers or government entities, plus two extensions, or 3 years for everyone else, plus two extensions. And there also has to be no or nominal risk to the authority. These are similar guardrails that are already in place for real estate. An example of this would be the ACE transmission line. ACE is about to start construction on the transmission line and needs a laydown area at the Windport in order to store some of its equipment. Second category is the execution of utility easements, same guardrails as the previous category, but this would be for the duration for the lifetime of the Windport. An example of this would be underground duct bank easement under PSE&G nuclear property that would be needed for power. We'll also need underground easements for potable water, sewer, and stormwater discharge. The third category is certain types of agreements with state entities. These are agreements that expect would come with standard terms and conditions and would not be subject to the negotiation between the parties. The two contemplated types of agreements would be NJDOT, their dredging activities. It's possible we may need them to undergo certain dredging activities to keep the earth channel clear of the Windport. And the second one being Treasury acceptance of project funds. So in summary, members are asked to approve the aforementioned delegations of authority to the CEO. Happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Anyone on the phone? Hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve?
I'll move it.
Second. Where's that, Jules? Did you second?
Yes.
Thank you. I don't know what I'd do without you. all those in favor signify by saying aye. Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions?
I think it's standing due to the potential of the EP permitting activity.
Got that?
Got it.
Okay. Thank you. Motion passes. Tim, board memorandum.
Yeah, I'll be brief, other than consistent with your comments a few moments ago, Chair, consistent with what Chris had presented on. As part of that board governance and function-led exercise that kicked off in 2019 and the report coming in 2020, which we're still implementing, we've gone through a series of delegations. We're going to continue to take a fresh look at what we can keep going on. We're taking approximately 50 or so delegation actions at this board, which means that the volume of delegated reports you're going to see going up, and this is today's memo pack of five or six memos, seven memos, is a good indication of that. You have included in that pack information on the Angel Investor Tax Credit Program, more details on the manufacturing voucher program that Ivan presented on earlier, including a list of everything that's been approved. And it just, again, a good reminder that a lot happens at these meetings, and that's critically important, but obviously a lot happens in the day-to-day operations led by our very capable and energetic staff. Thank you, Chairman.
And the board has all these memos.
Board has all these memos, and you've been distributed as part of that. I'm happy to take any questions on them now, offline, later.
For later.
Yeah, whenever at the convenience of any members.
right, thank you, Tim. Okay, I'd now like to open the public comment portion of the meeting. First, I'd like to ask Danielle Esser to read the NJEDA's public comment policy and process for this board meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As stated in the NJEDA's public comment policy, members of the public who wish to speak during the public comment period will be acknowledged to speak first in person, then by phone during the public comment portion of the meeting. Members attending, members of the public attending the meeting by phone who are interested in providing public comment can press 1 then 0 on their phone to be registered to speak, which will place each person into a queue based on the order received. And now we'll go over the public comment policy, which, as I mentioned, is also available on the NJEDA website. Each speaker will be prompted to speak one at a time. Each speaker should announce his or her name, organization, affiliation, and the topic on which remarks will be given. Each speaker will have a maximum of 3 minutes to speak and should limit their comments to matters pertaining to the authority. Staff will prompt the speaker once their time has expired. A person may not register to speak more than once during the same public comment period to ensure enough time is available for all of those who wish to speak, and related documents, printed comments, or materials may be attached to an email. We look forward to receiving your public comments at this time.
Thank you, Danielle. I will now acknowledge members of the public who wish to provide public comments. Anyone in the room? Should we go to the phone?
Alan, on the phone, can you prompt anybody on the phone to...
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, for members of the public on the phone, if you wish to ask a question, please press 1, then 0 on your telephone keypad. You may withdraw your question at any time by repeating the 1-0 command. If you are on a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question, press 1, then 0 at this time. One moment, please, for our first question. Again, if you have questions or comments, please take this opportunity now to press 1, then 0 on your telephone keypad.
Oh, you got them. All right.
We have no one in queue at this time.
Thank you, operator. If there are no additional comments, I'd like to thank everyone for their participation this morning. I'd like to now request a motion to enter executive session to discuss a real estate contract matter involving public funds where disclosure could adversely impact the public interest, the minutes of which will become available when the need for confidentiality no longer exists, but what will take place after the board returns to public session. Could I hear a motion to move to executive session?
So moved.
Second?
Yes, my second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Okay, hearing none, we're now going to go to executive session.
One moment, please.
Ladies and gentlemen, we do thank you for your patience. Please continue to hold the line. The conference will resume shortly.
You are now back in the main session.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, so we're back in the main session. Could I hear a motion to approve additional funding in the New Jersey Wind Port construction expenditure as discussed in executive session? Motion?
Move it.
Second?
Antoine, second.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions?
I'm going to abstain due to the potential of the AP permitting.
Thank you. Noted. Hearing no further opposition, the motion passes. Thank you. Jonathan, as always. If there are any additional business, any additional comments, questions from board members, Tim? Hearing none, thank you for a very productive board meeting this morning, and hopefully some of the things we're doing in terms of posting on programs and overviews is helpful to everybody. So thank you for attending physically, and thank you to those attending on the phone. Can I hear a motion to adjourn?
Yes,
what? Thank you.
All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. This concludes our meeting for today. See you in October.
And for more the next time.
Ladies and gentlemen, that will conclude your conference call for today. Thank you for your participation and for using AT&T Executive Teleconference. You may now disconnect.
Now, please hang up.